Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Now, we promised you that we would bring you another program, a second program on Nashville, the Music City Food and Wine Festival. And
So here we are.
And we actually, can you explain what this Midnight Harvest was?
Well, there are two main events. There's lots and lots of small events going on, but the biggest thing, I guess, that takes place is what they call the Grand Tasting, which is like a strolling by food station after food station after food station under tents in a very large grassy area near the state capital, a common format for food and wine festivals. And then the big event from a culinary standpoint is called Harvest Night. And honestly, not sure why it's called Harvest Night. Nobody ever explained that to me. But that happens on a different open piece of ground near the Country Music Hall of Fame, right in the shadow of the hockey arena.
But you know, most of these people who go there find the music component of that to be the big event.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we couldn't record that.
No, but anyhow, you're not allowed to do that. But it's the Kings of Leon.
Well, they're the leaders of the pack, and there's a whole lot of other people. But anyway, the first segment we're going to bring you is Harvest Night, which features name chefs from around the country, as well as top chefs in Nashville, and they all took. No, just a couple of minutes, because they were busy serving food. We did catch a few of them, and you want to do the list?
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean,
I'll do the list.
We're all brief, and we managed to talk to Jonathan Waxman, Mike Latta, Marcus Samuelson, Andrew Zimmern, Chris Bianco, and Miles and Johnny. Well, Miles, we didn't get his last name, but he's the chef with Johnny Sanchez.
Got it.
Right.
So here we go.
Jonathan Waxman is the reason why we first came to this Music City. And I don't even remember why, because we first met you in Australia, in Melbourne, and God knows when.
Anyhow. 2007.
2008. Never mind.
It's the other side of the world.
But
so.
Anyhow, you opened a restaurant here called Adele's, which we ate at last year and loved. And you're opening new concepts. You were originally, of course, based in New York. And talk to us about your new concepts.
Well, I have a little Mexican restaurant called Bajo Sexto, and it's nothing to do with pornography. What it is, it's Bajo Sexto because it's Music City. It's the 12-string guitar in the mariachi band. And it's a restaurant that I've been trying to do forever. I almost did it with my Mexican son, Aaron Sanchez.
It's in the Music City.
And so I started up, and Susanna Trilling, who's a very well-known writer in Oaxaca, her son was available to become our chef. And so we dragged him up from Oaxaca, and he has this thing called Nick's Tamal Machine, and he makes his own masa from stone corn, and it's just amazing. And we're opening another one, actually, come January here as well.
Can't wait. You're always on the move. The other thing you do is Alex's Lemonade Stand, don't you?
I do Alex's Lemonade Stand, but also I do actually a lot of charities. In fact, I'm doing one in Dallas next week for the wonderful park down there, the Klein Warren Park. And then in 2 weeks from now, I'm opening a restaurant in Atlanta in Pond City. So, and then in November, I'm opening Ghirardelli Square, San Francisco.
Yeah, I do know where Ghirardelli Square is.
A lot of people don't know where it is, but it's on the bay in San Francisco, right in front of the Maritime Museum, right where the Polar Bear Club is.
Well, thank you for talking to us, and thank you for introducing us to Nashville.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. Have fun.
Hi, my name is Mike Latta. We're here at the Nashville Music City Food and Wine Festival. And today at Harvest Night, we're going to serve grilled pizza with clams and arugula and horseradish.
Now you have a full-time, you have a chef designated now at Fig, right? So you're saying I'm the chef at The Ordinary?
Yeah. So Jason Stanhope's executive chef at Faggot. He's in charge of the daily operations of the restaurant. Absolutely. And eventually the Ordinary will have somebody like Jason, but the restaurant's still young and we're still developing the concept.
Great. Well, hope you're going to have a good time here in Nashville. I'm sure you will.
We sure are. Thank you.
Anything new?
Nothing new at all.
Just minding the fires.
It's just good to see you. Thanks. Can you just say?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Linton Hopkins, Restaurant Eugene, Atlanta, Georgia. Here at the music festival, we have veal meatballs with consomme, pickled peppers, and a little sriracha hot sauce. Thanks.
Is this your first trip here?
For this event, it is, but my mother grew up in Nashville, so this is home.
You're practically native. Thanks, Jeff.
I am native.
Name and why you're here?
My name's Kevin Corman. I'm chef of Kaliza Restaurant in Alice Beach, Florida. We're here to represent South Walton County, Florida. We're going to be serving a pecan and graham cracker blondie, a whipped goat cheesecake, and a little satsuma jam.
That sounds really terrific. I will be there. And here we go. Jason Paolini.
Hi, I'm Jason Paolini, and I'm with Restaurant Eugene as well. We're doing veal meatballs with the warm chicken broth. And, you know, I'm just here to enjoy the music and the food. And it's going to be an exciting event.
It's actually, we go to a lot of these, and this is really a good one.
This is a good one. This is a very good one. This is my first time here for the Nashville event, but I've been to Nashville before, and I love this town.
I never thought I'd love Nashville, but this, I don't know, I have a whole new perspective on it. It's getting really great. Thanks for talking to us.
Hmm? How long have you lived in Nashville?
I don't live in Nashville. I'm just here covering the event. I live in Pittsburgh. Have you ever been in Pittsburgh?
I have not. I'm down in Atlanta, and I've never been to Pittsburgh, but it's a great town from what I hear.
Got a great sausage.
You're bossy.
Did you do him too?
Yeah. Yes, we did.
Great.
Did you
stop the recording?
No. Marcus Samuelson, you have dodged our interview for like 10, 15 years. Now I have you. Hey.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me. What's happening?
Well, you've really shaken up the ranks of food ever since you started with the Swedish stuff and now the African stuff. We just interviewed somebody who wrote a book on Senegalese food, which is fabulous. So tell me how many restaurants you have and what they are and where they are.
I have Red Rooster and Street Bird in Harlem, and we have a restaurant called Marcus in Bermuda. And, you should come by. Good time.
You guys want to have some pork?
There you go.
Say what you're serving here.
Today we have a little jerk pork belly with a little bit of Haitian pickles, and you should try it. It's good. It's delicious. Good.
I am trying it. It's good. Good.
It's excellent. We already had it. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you very much. Enjoy the festival.
Andrew Zimmern, hello.
Hello, my dear. How are you?
Okay. Your television show, you have a new one.
We do. We're a brand new series comes out in April called Meters Running. 200th episode of Bizarre Foods airs in, I don't know, 5 or 6 weeks on Travel Channel. And we're producing a mess of cool shows for other people now, too. So I'm busy.
How are you involved with this festival?
Well, I've been coming here ever since they started. I think it's the best food festival in the country. I mean, it's number one, it's in Nashville. Number two, it brings food and music together. And it's the nicest people at any food festival on planet Earth. And I've done them all.
Yeah, well, we have too. I love the fact that you say things that are independent from what most other people say, and I love it. You've said things about people I know, and I think, I already know you're right.
Yeah, well, you know something? Here's the deal. I'm a little bit older than a lot of other people. I've seen a couple more things than a couple other people, and I think that, you know, I like to call them as I see them. And somehow, I think if you just stand up for being a nice person, you can be a little more honest than most others. So I try to be nice and honest. It's a nice combination.
What are you serving tonight, especially the best hot dog on earth?
You know, it's an all-beef Piedmontese hot dog. We call it the canteen dog. And it comes with a Eastern European-influenced slaw with lemon and mint, and it's got a fresh chili and dried mint shake on it, and we love them. People love them, too.
I'm having one now. Thank you for talking to us.
Enjoy the rest of the night. See you later.
Chef Chris Bianco, you were certainly a startler today. You're not in the Southwest, and you're not doing pizza. What are you doing here at this festival?
We're doing here at the festival today. We're doing a little beautiful grain salad. So I guess it's kind of a deconstructed pizza. It's grain, but if we milled it, it would be easily flour. But we're doing a whole grain warm salad. There's frika, which is...
I love frika.
Yeah, well, so we have frika, purple barley, white Sonoran wheat, and spelt, farro, and all grown in Arizona. And then we're doing that with verdolagas, purslane, a little bit of zucchini that we dry and tomato that we dry. And then we finish that with a romesco style sauce, but instead of almonds, we use fried chickpeas that we so it's pretty nice. It's a vegetarian dish, just because it is. And
I want to eat it. I'm going to eat it.
Stay tuned.
Hello. Are you still with one restaurant?
No, I've got four.
I missed that. Tell me.
We've got a couple Pizzeria Biancos, one in Tucson, Arizona, and two in Phoenix. A little trattoria that we have, a little bakery, Pane Bianco, and a little wine bar that we've had for years, Bar Bianco. So just kind of crawling around, you know. Happy to be here in Nashville.
I'm so pleased to meet you. I missed you at the James Beard Awards. You always passed by, never talked to me.
I'm always on the move. I'm always running hard. But anyway, glad you got me today. I'm grateful.
Thank you.
Brother Aaron, right there.
Johnny,
I'm Miles.
You're Miles. Okay. John Besh is a really good friend of ours, and I'm really pleased to meet you. I don't know why we never met before. Your restaurant is called...
It's called Johnny Sanchez. So it's a collaboration between John Besh and Aaron Sanchez.
Okay. And how do you fit in, Mike?
So I've worked for John Besh for about 5 years now. And along the way, I started hanging out with Aaron Sanchez at different events, and I went down to Mexico and took what I learned cooking at August, and we've opened a Mexican restaurant.
Okay, so when did this restaurant open?
This particular restaurant we opened last year. We opened one in Baltimore in August of 2014 and one in New Orleans in October of 2014.
We're always in New Orleans for the festival, and we missed it this year. I haven't been to Shia yet, which is getting the greatest rave reviews.
Shia is outstanding. Alon's a good friend of mine, and he's doing very good things.
So, but you're now cooking Mexican?
I am. I do Mexican, but what we're so proud of at Johnny Sanchez is we use everything in South Louisiana that we like to eat and cook and catch, and we turn it into Mexican food, which is
I'm glad that you're able to be at this event. And good to meet you, and we'll see you next in New Orleans.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure to meet you, and thanks for coming by.
And we'll be back with more voices from the Music City Food and Wine Festival after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and so here's more from the Music City Food and Wine Festival. One of the hearts of this festival is this huge area where the pitmasters perform. And let me tell you, these guys are really, and I think they're all guys, but maybe one or two, but most of them are guys. And it was hot. It was like 89 degrees or something, and these flames were rising up, and I mean, I don't know how they could stand it. But anyhow, the guy who's the leader of the pack is a pit master named Pat Martin, and we're going to talk to him. Then, strolling around some more into the actual the tasting, I lit on Pano Caritasis, who is from Atlanta, a restaurant called Kima, who had my favorite food of all times is octopus, and they were actually doing octopus over live fire also. And then we get to a pop-up
little octopus, and then the Lachlan table with the very excited choreogram.
I never really thought I was going to get close enough to Pat Martin to be able to get him to say a few words. This is the busiest site in the whole Music City Food and Wine Festival. Pat, thank you for talking to us.
Anytime. Happy to do it.
You're sort of the king of barbecue. You say not, but I think. how many barbecue places do you have, restaurants?
I've got three here in Nashville, and I've got one in Morgantown, West Virginia.
Why Morgantown?
I have a business partner that was a WVU grad, so, okay. Yeah.
Now, you have a whole huge quadrant here for barbecuing. You have whole animals. What are you offering up here?
We're offering fish, cold roasted vegetables, lamb, goat, hog, pig, Denver lamb ribs, yakitori chicken over there. I mean, just all beef ribs, all kinds of stuff.
Do you ever count how many people you serve?
Not a bit.
When I say that, listeners, it's because the lines are just, they snake around the whole part of the park here, and everybody walks away with platters full.
Yeah, there's a lot of people, but I don't count. But we're blessed. Everybody, I think, really likes this and appreciates all this live fire cooking. And I think people can see that even though it's over coals, it's still very elegant.
You mean as opposed to wood?
Well, coal, wood, same thing, anything. But it's a live fire, but it's very elegant.
Now, you are a certified pit master, right?
I don't know about certified. I've been cooking barbecue for 25 years. Maybe that gives me a check on the box, but I don't know about certified.
Now, in addition to this, do you go around the country to all these other pit master stops?
I do. Yeah, I do some things. Big Apple Block Party, food and wine festivals. I'm not a competition barbecue guy. I'm more of a traditionalist. So, but I do. I'm blessed to be able to get around some. Yes.
In fact, your vehicle is right behind us as we sit here, right? So what you tow around is right behind you.
Yeah, yes, it is. It's my barbecue pit, and that's one of them. That's how we get wherever we're gonna go, where we're gonna cook.
And you go to Danny Meyer's Big Apple Barbecue. Is that as far away as you go?
I do that. This is my seventh year this past year. We've done Denver, Miami, South Beach, Chicago, Austin, pretty everywhere. I mean, we've done a lot of places. Birmingham.
Now this stand over here, which occupies a quarter of the whole display here, it says Pat Martin and Friends. So you've got people that are good cronies of yours who you're getting them signed up to help with the cooking?
Yes. They're all helping me out, all these good guys right here.
Who's here? Because they're all over there pulling his leg. I don't know, listeners, if you can hear some of the assistants in the background, but they're making a lot of noise. So who's with you? Who's with you today? Just to show you, you're a nice guy.
Billy Durney from Brooklyn, New York. You need to interview Billy. He's one of the premier past up and coming pit masters right here. Yeah, he's got the best. Yeah, this guy right here. Danny Wilson, Andrew Zimmern, Sam Jones. He's in there. He's busy right now wrapping up some stuff. So there's a lot of people. It's a lot of fun.
I just heard Aaron Franklin. Yeah, I just heard Aaron Franklin, Franklin Barbecue in Austin, interviewed, and he said everybody asked him what's his secret, and he said there isn't a secret. How about you?
He's exactly right. There is no secret. Real pit masters don't have secrets.
You're a doll. Thank you. Everybody ends up, I think, at this Music and Wine Festival and Food Festival, including Pano Caritasos, who is here representing the Buckhead Life Restaurant Group. Also with your restaurant, which restaurant are you really wearing the cap of at this event, Tano?
So I am the executive chef of restaurant Kima, which is a Greek seafood restaurant, as well as the corporate chef of Buckhead Life Restaurant Group.
Founded by in the 70s by your dad?
Yes, my my father started the company, Buckhead Life Restaurant Group, back in 1979. And we currently have 9 restaurants in Atlanta. We have a bread company, a seafood company, and then we also have 3 restaurants down in South Florida with another one on the way to make 4.
I just had your octopus. It's you are very traditional, but very, very good. But you are a traditional Greek chef, right?
I do tradition, but I am also very modern as well. So Kima sort of is a mixture of great seafood products that I can get in from Greece. I usually fly my fish in less than 24 hours out of the water, direct from Greece to Atlanta to Kima. And so the tradition is what I purchased, but then I definitely have my spin and take on Greek food as well, too. And my focus is, you know, cooking healthy and really paying attention to a great diet that actually tastes great and is fun to eat and is also something different that people enjoy.
And we just interviewed this chef who wrote a book. She's from that island that where everybody lives over 100, the blue zone. Do you know what I'm talking about? Was it Diane?
Yeah. So Diane Kochelis, and she's a great author, a great historian of Greek food. She has she's also a great chef, great cook. She has a couple of restaurants herself, and also is a great friend of mine.
Well, tell me this. I haven't been to Greece in a long time. Do they still actually bring you the fresh fish out to examine and you select it before they cook it for you?
Yes, in Greece, it's very typical for the customer to see the fish and that they're going to purchase, and they take it back in the kitchen and they clean it, cook it, bring it right back out to you. So that's very common, and it's something you see a lot of on the islands. And in some of the great ports.
Well, I can't wait to see what you're going to produce later on today. And I enjoyed talking to you. And we'll have to set up a time to visit Atlanta and your restaurants there. And thank you. I know you're so busy. You're just on edge having to get back here. So I'll let you go. But thank you. Afaristo.
I look forward to having you come to Atlanta and try out the food that I'm doing at Kima. Thank you.
So here's a question, Daniel Hergé or Hergert or however it's pronounced. When is a restaurant not a restaurant here in Nashville?
When is a restaurant not a restaurant? That's an interesting question. I think Nashville has a distinct opportunity right now to really develop a restaurant culture because it hasn't really been here yet.
What I meant was you don't actually have a building, but you have a space where you can run a restaurant, and that's what I meant by when is a restaurant not a restaurant.
I think a restaurant really could be anywhere. I think some of the most interesting concepts that I've seen, like Room 40 out in LA, their whole concept is restaurant without walls. And I think that especially as we move forward with a lot of different pop-up dining and things like that, we're really redefining every day what a restaurant really is. Do you have to have walls? Well, no. I mean, it's really about the service and presenting an experience to the guests. That's what makes a restaurant a restaurant.
And you have to have a funky name like Little Octopus and a great little taste like avocado with something. Tell us something more about that.
Well, it certainly doesn't hurt to have a funky name, and we have had a lot of response to that, and we're very happy with it. And a lot of the dishes that we try to do, they're very much inspired by Central South America and Caribbean Latino cuisine. I grew up in Florida, spent a lot of time in Miami, so I bring a lot of that influence. And I think that just bright, vibrant flavors is really what I gravitate towards.
Yeah, what is Pop Nashville?
So Pop Nashville is a pop-up dining and event space. So we house our resident restaurant, which is Little Octopus, and we also host pop-up dinners and events. We actually just had a few well-known chefs come in for a series we call City Meets Nashville. We had Daniel Hines from McCrady's. We had Andy Ricker from Pock Pock out in Oregon come out. So we do some one-off events and maybe, you know, one or two nights here where we have big-name chefs come in and do plated dinners. And we also serve as a commissary for some of the local food trucks and food businesses.
Do you actually have octopus on your menu?
Absolutely, we have octopus. We have a jerk spiced octopus with bamboo rice grits. So it's a little take on shrimp and grits, kind of a play on that, a classic southern dish. And people seem to really like it, and we're very happy with our offering so far.
Anne hopes you're going to bring some of that tomorrow, right, love?
No, I want to know how long, like, Little Octopus is in the pop-up space.
So Little Octopus is about 3 months old. We've been there for 3 months, and we plan to be there for about a year. And after that year mark, we're going to decide whether we're going to stay in that space or find our own space for Little Octopus for that concept to continue to grow.
And somebody else moves into Pop Nashville?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, listeners, you'll probably hear this. There's a little bit of noise in the background. There's a slight ocean of calm right here. Daniel, I suspect you're going to get busy in just a second, so we better let you go back to work.
Thank you. It was nice talking to you.
Here's an interesting question for
Cara Graham.
What do you do at the Nashville Music City Food and Wine Festival when you just gave away your last piece of food?
You start drinking.
The secret, listeners, is actually 5 minutes ago when there was still food here, she said, forget about the food. I'm ready for something to drink. But that's not what Lachlan Table is all about, is it?
No, not at all. Lachlan Table is all about the food. Simple food, simple recipes, a simple concept. Good service, good food. You know, we try to keep it interesting, and we have some things for, you know, people that want to be interesting, like the smoked bone marrow and the chicken liver pate and the crispy pig ears, which you noticed on the menu, which are really fun. But then we have something like spaghetti and meatballs, which is just downright comfort food, because sometimes you just need that. So I think we have a menu that's designed for whatever you're feeling. It's emotional.
Now, the restaurant you said, I think you told me, is just about to be 3 years old.
We just turned 3 years old in August.
And where in Nashville will people find it?
East Nashville, which is right now is, you know, one of those happening spots. But we feel that we got there before then.
So this is like an emerging part of Nashville, and it's across the Cumberland River, if I'm correct?
It is. It's about, we're about 16 blocks in from the Cumberland River. I've lived there for about 10 years now, so I kind of feel like there's others that are bigger pioneers than I am, but I definitely feel like we are one of the pioneers in the food industry in East Nashville.
Now, tell us a little bit, you mentioned the name of the team before we started recording. Go over the team for us again.
The team?
Yeah.
So I am the general manager and a co-owner. And then my business partner is Chef Hal Holdenbach. He's on your card. He and I, he runs the kitchen. I run at the front of the house. And we have, hands down, the most amazing staff in Nashville, period.
If you opened about 3 years ago, you were just ahead of the curve for the hot restaurant scene in Nashville. What niche was it you saw that needed to be filled?
Well, in our particular case, we are in a neighborhood. We are surrounded by residential, and we really fit the need of walkable restaurants. something where you can run your you can wear your running clothes. If you can walk your baby down, you can come for a fantastic date night. It is comfortable enough for all those scenarios.
Yeah, well, I want to point out that I was taken with your beef, your chimichurri sauce beef grilled. But also, looking over your menu, you have a lot of really specific and superior products on it, such as the Benson's bacon, and your local cheeses. You identify them from where they're from. Not all of them are local, but a lot of them are. We already know all of the Sinclair chocolates. We've interviewed them. So there's a strong local affiliation here on quality products. So I think you...
Absolutely. We consider ourselves 40% local, well, maybe more, 60% local, regional, or domestic. So all of our products, as well as our wine list and our products behind the bar, as well as our menu, are all seasonal. We have a farmer that grows specifically for us, who basically dictates our menu. He and Chef Hal have a conversation before every season, and they decide what they're gonna grow, or what's growing well this year, or what's and that's how we base our menu. We have lots of amazing, great friends in Nashville that we try to support, like you said, Olive and Sinclair. There's lots of people like that on our list that we try to feature. There's Pickers Vodka, is a brand new local distillery that we're using here. They distill right here in Nashville, and they're at a price point where they can become our brand. Yeah. So we really define ourselves in ourselves and the others around us.
Well, I'm glad I found you, and from what I've sampled and looking at your menu, next year at this time, we'll have a reservation at your restaurant.
I love it.
Thank you.
It was so nice to meet you guys. Safe travels.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We're still in Nashville, but we took a step away from the Music City Food and Wine Festival to try to understand a little bit more about how Nashville eats when there isn't a festival going on. It turns out there's a lot of other stuff. It seems like conventions, and especially to do with country music, going on just about all the time. And last year we met a really nice young man called Jay Flatley, who's the chef at a very casual but very busy restaurant called the Tavern, part of a group. Again, seems like a popular thing in Nashville. They have four or five restaurants, yeah, of which Jay will talk about. To give you an idea, they started opening for brunch at 10 o'clock on Saturday. Then everybody started arriving at 10:15, so now they open at 9:30. And they're busy all through the week, and you can see why the atmosphere is boisterous. The food is sustaining.
Very sustaining.
The drink is substantial. Here's Chef Jay Flatley from the Tavern.
Now, we met Chef Jay Flatley last year at Music City Food and Wine Festival, and somehow we just couldn't get in a visit and an interview, but we're correcting that today. Thanks for having us over, Jay. Could you start by... First of all, this restaurant is called Tavern, and Tavern Midtown is the location, is it?
Yes, ma'am.
Some of your background, I was really impressed with. You've cooked for just about every conceivable clientele and in many, many cities and locations and different groups. Explain a little bit, condensed version of your life.
Well, I was... I cooked a lot with my mom, sister growing up, and they threw a lot of events and parties, and that got me started as hospitality, I guess you would say. And it's something that's always thrilled me, just moving around from my birthplace in New Orleans to
Texas and New York and Florida and now here in Nashville, and it's been a great ride, but I'm happy to be here where I'm at.
Well, now, you've spent a lot of your time cooking in the South, but you went to school at the Culinary Institute of America, which is New York. You worked in Manhattan, but are you back, you think, to your Southern roots cooking-wise?
Yes, ma'am, for certain. You know, that's where I was raised and, you know, what I love to do.
Tell us kind of where we are in terms of town here.
We're located in Midtown, which is between West End, I guess you would say, and downtown Nashville, where it's pretty much centralized around Vanderbilt University. So there's a lot of places around here.
Now, you say that you have a very high volume here, and you're used to that because you worked in a lot of high volume places, but that it's high volume with a difference, and that is you and your sous chef, who's also from the CIA, do it right, from making everything in-house fresh and from scratch.
Yes, we do everything we get in fresh almost every day, and we build it up from scratch every morning. So, you know, it's something that our guests love to enjoy on a regular basis, and, you know, I think that's why we, you know, are who we are and stay high volume and, you know, keep the regulars coming back.
Give me a sense of so many chefs and restaurateurs from other parts of the country are moving into Nashville, opening places. I mean, how has that affected the local dining scene?
I think that, you know, with the newcomers and everybody coming into Nashville these days, I think a lot of people are more inclined to go out in general and, you know, try new things. And, you know, we've, you know, our consistency has kept us, you know, in the limelight, you know, not just here at Tavern, but across the board at all of our other locations in the company. You know, it's a reliable experience that, you know, you can come in, especially out of town, and, you know, a concierge may recommend it. You know, people are really never disappointed, you know, and a lot of people they'll eat here and go try another one of the places, and, you know, it's just a great, hospitable dining experience.
Run us through the other restaurants in this group. The group is called?
We are M Street, and besides Tavern, we have San Anejo, which is our Latin concept. We have Whiskey Kitchen, which is a, just like it says, Whiskey Kitchen, kind of revolving around bar food kind of scene. We have Virago, which is our Asian fusion and sushi bar. Moto, which is our eclectic Italian cuisine. And then Cane Prime, which is the steakhouse, you know, which has gotten rave reviews as one of the best steakhouses in the city, if not the country. So they do, you know, we do a good job.
Well, you ought to be right at home with steak coming from Texas.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, how would you characterize this restaurant, Tavern?
I would say we're basically a gastropub. You know, we have many different styles of drinks. You know, we keep all the latest craft brews on tap, and, you know, we changing the menu as often as possible as we see, you know, trends changing and whatnot, trying to stay, you know, fresh with the hip crowd, I guess you would say, you know, and I think that, you know, attracts people to come and try us out.
Did you say this is an historic building?
No.
I couldn't tell. There's so many historic buildings around town, I could hardly tell. You said that one of your biggest day parts is brunch.
We've gotten best brunch in Nashville for the past 2 or 3 years, and, you know, we keep it consistent, and, you know, we have a line out the door every weekend, so, you know.
What's on the menu?
We have your traditional Eggs Benedicts. We do a Nova Scotia-style Eggs Benedict with smoked salmon and poached eggs and caper hollandaise. You know, we have a southern style with grilled ham and poached egg and hollandaise. And we do a short rib benedict with Tabasco hollandaise and sous vide short rib. We have omelets. You know, we do a ham and brie omelet. We do a caramelized onion and smoked salmon omelet. And we do peppers and squash with a mushroom relish. We also have, you know, on the healthy side, we do egg white scrambles, all that good stuff. And we have a red velvet waffle with cream cheese icing, which is the crowd favorite. People love the it's a red velvet waffle, kind of like a red velvet cake with the icing. And we also do a blueberry waffle with Louisiana cane syrup and homemade mascarpone. And we have pretzel pancakes, which are sweet and salty. And, you know, it's an eclectic little menu, but, you know, it's a crowd pleaser for sure.
Now, you said that you used to start brunch at 10 o'clock. I should mention, by the way, it's both Saturday and Sunday?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
But then the crowd started coming early, so what did you do?
We opened early. We opened at 9:45 now.
So if you want to get a table right away, you better show up at 9:40?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Or 9:30 would probably be the best.
This menu that I'm looking at, is this a lunch menu or an all-day menu? Is there a separate dinner menu?
It's an all-day menu.
There's so much on. I have no idea how you would start ordering. What are some of your favorite features on this menu? And describe so our listeners like a little food porn thrown in there. So if you describe some of these dishes.
Okay. Some of my favorites would be the fried chicken skins. You know, we get fresh raw chicken skins in and fry them as you would, similar to like a pork rind. And it's got, we put homemade spicy salt and smoked honey on top. You know, it's kind of a, I like it a lot, but you know, if you've never had a chicken skin before, it's probably, you know, kind of.
I make it.
Yeah, you know, they're delicious. Our buffalo cauliflower is a huge seller, crowd pleaser. It's basically just fried cauliflower, fried crispy, then toss in your traditional buffalo sauce with blue cheese dressing. Egg rolls are always a hit. It's Philly cheesesteak egg rolls with cheese whiz and spicy ketchup. Some of the newer items we're doing is a hot crab dip with serranos and bacon and mozzarella. Of course, we have our Tuscan kale salad, which is chopped kale served raw with toasted almonds, currants, and Parmesan cheese. Crowd pleaser there all day long. Some of my other favorites would be the ham jam sandwich, which is it's a crispy baguette with ham and pepper jelly with shrimp salad. And our burgers, you know, we pride ourselves on our burger. We have a hickory fire grill, wood fire grill, which we cook all our burgers on, and all of our chicken and our meats in general. And you know, people love our burger.
Son of a brown bag.
We used to have we just put that on the menu this past week. It's we had originally a brown bag, which was just a basic bologna, hot bologna sandwich, you know, with cheese and hot mayonnaise on Texas toast. But we've kind of upped the par on it, and we serve it with crispy onions. It's on a melt-away bun with a fried egg. So, you know, we kind of upgraded that one a little bit.
How are your lobster sliders and your mussels?
We get the mussels in fresh every day. You know, they are Prince Edward Island, you know, so they're consistently delicious mussel. You know, it's a very basic preparation with bacon and the white wine and charred tomato and leeks and a little bit of garlic and butter. And we serve it with a crispy baguette for dipping, of course. The lobster sliders are modeled after your typical lobster roll in New England style, but we serve it on Sister Schubert's rolls, which are local favorite, Sister Schubert's out of it's a company out of the South that makes dinner rolls and, you know, like your typical Thanksgiving style roll, you know, so it's real, real savory, delicious sandwich. And we have some entrees that, you know, crowd pleasers as well. You know, we do grilled salmon, which we serve with this season with I can't remember this.
Grilled baby bok choy.
Yeah, we have baby bok choy, chili scallion rice, which is like a little stir fry. And we there's a Asian seasoning we put on there that's togarashi. Oh, there it is. Seasoned with togarashi, which is a super flavorful seasoning. The fish and chips we just put on this past week as well. It's a pakora style, which is Indian for like a fried snack. So it's you've got all the seasonings of, you know, your paprika, your cumin, and coriander, and all that seasoned in your fish, and it's served with truffle fries.
Now, I turned the menu, and here we have libations. If I thought it was tough ordering from the the food side of the menu, I don't know where to start. Is there some kind of guiding principle about this drinks menu?
I think, you know, our drinks kind of model who we are and the kind of, you know, just the range of, you know, choices you can have when you come to tavern. You know, we use all kinds of, you know, local and specialty liqueurs and, you know, boozes. And, you know, we keep it fresh, you know, try to change it as often as possible.
Now, I haven't seen any sweets here. Do you do desserts? I mean, I find that really odd for a southern restaurant not to have desserts.
Yes, ma'am. We do a basic, cinnamon roll bread pudding with vanilla ice cream. So, you know, traditional bread pudding, but cinnamon based, you know, it's like a Cinnabon bread pudding, you know, with vanilla ice cream. We do a s'mores, which is actually, we present the s'mores in a pan with a candle, which is kind of like a pyre kind of torch thing that, you know, the guests can toast their marshmallows at the table and make their own s'mores at the table. You know, and my sous chef slash pastry chef comes up with different, you know, desserts throughout the week that, you know, we sell as specials. And, you know, we have your basic chocolate vanilla ice cream, you know, for anyone who's looking for that. We usually run a specialty ice cream, and this week it's banana split, so.
Well, I mean, I think anybody could just move in here and find something. Anybody will find anything that they want on this menu. You've covered all bases. What's still left on your wish list for this restaurant?
You know, between myself, I speak for myself and my team here, we're very happy with what we do. You know, a lot of people that work in this restaurant have been here for many years, and, you know, we try to keep it positive and, you know, a good environment for not only our guests but for our, you know, our staff as well, you know. And, you know, I pride myself in that and keeping that going, you know. And it's, you know, I'm basically just talking it all up to experience at this point, you know. I don't have any plans in the immediate future. You know, I'm happy where I'm at.
Well, I think all of your employees should be very happy to have such a nice boss. I mean, you're so pleasant on top of everything else. And I can't wait to taste the food. Thank you for taking time to talk to us.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for coming in.
Now, not for nothing is the Music City Food and Wine Festival called the Wine Festival. But it turns out there are lots and lots of beverages, all very interesting, all pretty exciting, and a common theme to many of them is that great old southern delicacy called
bourbon.
And the bourbon stands were so busy.
Oh, yeah, there were a lot of them, too.
We didn't have much of an opportunity to record on site, but then we remembered that we had recently interviewed a gentleman who knows a lot about bourbon, so much so that he wrote a book called Bourbon Curious.
And his name is Fred Minnick.
Fred Minnick. And
he's an expert on bourbon.
And Fred Minnick's book has lots and lots of stories all about bourbon, which is the kind of thing that you'd get if you went behind the scenes at the Nashville Food and Wine Festival. So this guy just fits right in. Seems like a great way to end today's program. Fred Minnick would be considered by many to have a rather obscure occupation because he admits he's a whiskey writer. Now, how do you grow up to get to be a whiskey writer, Fred?
So the story is I came home, it's kind of connected to my military career. I was in Iraq. I came home, and as a civilian, I couldn't get a job. And my skill sets are basically photography and writing. And the only job I could get was in Louisville, Kentucky, as a food editor for a trade outlet, so a group that covered the trade side of the food industry. When I was in this position, I kind of like vaguely covered alcohol on a very, you know, periphery kind of level. I decided to go out on my own in 2006. I think every editor at some point thinks that they can make more money and they're smarter than their bosses and everything, and so we all eventually go out on our own as freelancers.
Okay.
Some of us fall flat on our face. That's kind of, but one of the things that you do when you're a freelancer, you start covering what's in your region. And, you know, being based in Louisville, Kentucky, I started covering bourbon because there's so much of it here. There's a lot of culture around it. And I was covering wine at the same time. And I just fell in love with bourbon. I just kept writing about it and writing about it. And it really blossomed into a profession. And I would say probably around 2010, 2011, when I got contract for my first whiskey book, Whiskey Women, that's when I really knew that I need to focus almost 100% of my time onto whiskey.
Now, if you decided to have a meeting of all the whiskey writers in the world in a hotel, would you need a very big one?
No, there's only about 15 of us who write full-time. There are a lot of whiskey bloggers, and there are a lot of people who want to write about whiskey. But in terms of people who do this for their living, there's about 10 to 15 of us.
Right. In this case, what was your objective with this book? I mean, I know what came out. What came out of it was a history book with tons of absolutely fascinating anecdotes about whiskey lore. Is that what you set out to do?
So with Bourbon Curious, I wanted a book that geeks could pick up and learn a lot more about bourbon. And I wanted a book that would put newbies in the right direction. So there's so many people coming into bourbon whiskey today. They're walking into a liquor store and they say, I want something that's good. And that's all they go in with.
Okay.
The liquor store guys don't really give them a whole lot. And so my book gives them kind of the information they need from a flavor profile, all the major brands, and it breaks things down kind of like a sommelier would, saying like, you know, this style of bourbon will be very grain forward. So if you like corn on the cob, you're going to love it. If you like nutmeg, you're going to love Woodford. If you like caramel, you're going to love Maker's Mark. If you love cinnamon, you're going to love Four Roses Small Batch. So I wanted to give a different approach to bourbon, kind of in the same league as like wine takes when it's breaking down the different regions of the country or of the winemaking regions.
Now, this is in the later part of the book, right?
Right. Yeah, in the beginning, you know, I wanted to. There are so many myths and, you know, sales tactics and marketing teams that have been, you know, thrusting their will upon the consumers with bourbon. And, you know, those were developed for good reason. I mean, American whiskey was connected to slavery, prostitution, the Indian traders who would ended up causing a lot of the wars we would have with tribes in the 1800s. So American whiskey started falling into this, like, legends, and they started creating these myths. And these would carry on for a very long time, and, in fact, you know, major publications like the New York Times would publish them. And then we get into the Internet age, where we all start looking around and saying, wait, Elijah Craig didn't invent bourbon. The legend is that the barrels get charred inside during a barn fire. Well, I mean, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, how does the inside of a barrel get charred and the outside, you know, remain perfectly fine during a barn fire?
Okay, so this is just a good read. I mean, this is like a almost like a mystery. The mystery of how bourbon managed to survive the mess that people tried to make of it.
Yeah, I mean, and look, it's become folklore, and the legend, you know, the legends became facts, and then we kind of look at it like mythology. And now it was used so much that that really is the history of it. And the fact is, it's whiskey. No one's going to send a fact checker on verifying the origins of a particular whiskey brand. There's a lot of acceptance with the tongue in cheek, and heck, I even have that. I fall victim to it many times, but fun, loving, you know, industry. There's a high level of BS acceptance if you become a whiskey nerd.
I like your appendix with the brand histories because we've interviewed most of these people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're
especially Julian Van Winkle, loved him because we were at an event in Charleston, South Carolina, and there were only two potable beverages, beer and Pappy's, and decided that was an altogether satisfactory thing to drink with fried green tomatoes. She swore that she could drink it with just about anything.
Yeah, consider yourself lucky that you were able to hit some. It's so hard to get.
Sean Brock always has a barrel. Yeah.
But the funny thing was that we are talking to Julian, and Julian's in this terrible position that it doesn't matter how much Pappy Van Winkle people want to buy.
It's not available.
He only has so much he can sell for another 8 years until he gets ready.
Yeah, well, we have Angel's Envy, we had Michter's we liked a lot, we've flung around with the Jim Beam people over and over. They're like the family names, you know, they're always around.
Yeah, and I think that's why bourbon resurrected itself a little bit, is these families are so passionate and the culture is so supportive of the families, and, you know, they never really... You know, a lot of big names did kind of go away. Dance, the Wathens. I mean, there's a lot of big distillery names that we no longer see, but most of them survived. And ones that didn't, you know, and there's been a lot of new blood come in the equation in the last, you know, 25, 30 years. So the passion behind bourbon right now is at an all-time high.
So why, do you suppose? It's the lure of history and... I mean, it's American.
This is something that's fun, and as an author, this is fun to analyze and kind of come up with your own theory. My theory is that bourbon started declining during the 1960s, and what happened in the 1960s was the growth of the white spirits category. In 1952, vodka sold only about 1% of the total spirits for that year. In the 1960s, a guy gets on TV or a film and says he wants a martini shaken and not stirred. And that kind of, you know, hit home with that generation. That generation stopped drinking what their parents and their grandparents drank, which was a lot of it was bourbon. And so they started moving on toward these trendier at that time. Vodkas lasted into the 1990s, and really the peak of vodka was probably when Sex and the City was on the air. The 2000s hit... You know, the 2000s hit, and bourbon's starting to make a comeback because, you know, the families never died out. The passion never died in Kentucky. I mean, people divested and things shifted a little bit, but the distilleries kept churning out really good whiskey. And you had a guy named Elmer T. Lee come out with, you know, the first commercially available single barrel. You had Booker No with, you know, Jim Beam coming out with the small batch.
He was a riot.
He was great. I mean, you know, so you had all these really huge pioneers creating great whiskey, and then, you know, the 2000s hit, and Generation X, and then later the millennials, they didn't want to drink what their parents drank, which was vodka. So they start picking up bourbon, and bourbon is probably the one category in spirits that, you know, the distillery business did not necessarily forecast this demand. This was organic growth. I mean, this was just taken up, like women are... You know, make up about 37% of the bourbon drinking population right now, according to, you know, recent data from Jim Beam. And so you have all of these things happening organically. And now the distilleries, I mean, there's something like $800 million worth of improvements happening in Kentucky right now from the major distilleries and the small ones. I mean, it's amazing what's going on. Keep that in mind. You still have the distilleries in New York. You have distilleries in Wyoming and California, Indiana. You have Oregon, Washington. You have bourbon being made all over the country. And for the first time, really, ever, you have bourbon that's being distilled outside of Kentucky that can compete with Kentucky bourbon.
Now, of course, you've got the story of Tennessee whiskey and Jack Daniels and the feud over whether or not you should be allowed to call it bourbon, even though it's made in used barrels.
It's made in new barrels. And, you know, they in Tennessee, they don't want to call it bourbon. So I think, you know their charcoal mellowing process that they do, the maple charcoal they do before it goes in the barrel, I think that should be enough to keep them, you know, from allowing it to call them bourbon. And they are working. And they got state law there now. I mean, it hasn't, changed since we started this interview. So,
Fred, the big thing wasn't about it being called bourbon, I guess. It was about it being called Tennessee whiskey.
Yeah, they want to be called Tennessee whiskey. They want a market differentiator, okay, you know, from bourbon.
And
so.
George Dickel wanted to be able to call it Tennessee whiskey, even though it was made in used barrels.
They wanted to use used barrels because, you know, kind of the underbelly story to this was there's off and on a barrel shortage, and they're having to procure younger trees to make barrels. It's a very difficult time right now for the cooperages because they're having to meet all the demand that from the distilleries, and they're servicing all of them.
Got it, yes.
So,
right.
A lot of it had to do, you know, these guys were likely projecting the future demands, and they saw that as a potential loophole. It ended up being a real nasty mess, and I'm kind of glad it's over because it was not a very fun thing to cover for me. I prefer talking about, you know, the good things of
happy things.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Now, have you run across the Nelson boys? Who are,
Charlie yesterday.
Aren't they a fabulous story? I mean,
we've interviewed them.
Yeah, their grandfather, was it, or their great grandfather, dominated the market, probably sold more than Jack Daniels did. But then,
they lost track. Yeah. And, you know, Prohibition did that to a lot of companies. And, you know, that was a tough time in general. And we're really just now getting our footing back. But, you know, with that comes heavy responsibility. Like, we've had distilleries blow up, you know, people have died, you've had people catch themselves on fire, you know, so you have, and just today, in Louisville, there was a distillery that, was basically shut down by the government because they didn't have the proper permits.
Oh,
so with all this growth, we're beginning to see the other side. Like the government, the growth has been kind of happening, and people like Charles, you know, Charlie Nelson and them, you know, his brother have been great. You know, they're the good side of the story. But the other side are people who are just getting into it, you know, to make money or to do something sexy. And so the growth has government and some of the lobby groups, you know, with their connections to distilling, a little, you know, uncomfortable because all it takes is one or two really bad accidents to create bad legislation for the entire industry. So we are in a very interesting time.
Yeah. Now it's interesting. We're going to Nashville for the second time. It's actually the third event of the Music City Food and Wine Festival, and it's interesting that for the first time since probably ever, but certainly since Prohibition, they have like five or six distilleries that are in eyeshot of the courthouse. Is it Davidson County? I can't.
Yeah, so, I mean, Nashville's, you know, you got Corsair. And,
right.
You know, I mean, what they've done is nothing short of amazing. I mean, they've developed a new style of American whiskey.
What is it?
No one saw coming. They do a lot of smoke. So they use, you know, there have been other people do smoked whiskeys in this country, but Corsair is the one that really, you know, started using different woods. They started using the different oaks. It's just, it's fascinating what they've done.
Now, I have a question for you, Fred Minnick. I mean, you're so immersed in the world of bourbon, and everything's flying high right now. Have you ever been tempted to get into the other end of it, the production?
Of the what? On the production side of things?
Yeah, like investing in the distilleries or anything like that.
Well, if you saw my bank account, you would know I wouldn't have a whole lot to invest. So there's that aspect of it. The other aspect is like as soon as I do something like that, I can't cover, you know, the business. And I'm a writer. You know, I'm a journalist. I've covered things my entire career. And if an opportunity was presented to me, I mean, I'd basically be saying goodbye to, you know, who I am and what I've done my entire life. So opportunities have come to me like that, and
I've said
no. I've turned down a lot of work with distilleries because I want to be able to cover them still and remain objective.
Right. So you have ink on your fingers, not bourbon, right?
Yeah, I got a little bourbon on my fingers.
But the bourbon heads for a different part of your body.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I really enjoy covering it. I like writing about it. I like the stories. I largely like everyone involved.
Well, I liked your book too. I thought it was a wonderful combination of, if you like, a commercial history, a social history, and then the absolutely essential component for those of us who don't have quite as many years of drinking bourbon under our belt as the newbie experimenter, a guide to helping to make sure that their first bourbon experiences are good ones. It's an important work, and I hope that you feel like the bourbon community recognizes you for doing a good job of that.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, I mean, there's a lot of information in the book, and you know, not everyone's wanting all that dirty laundry aired out. But I think it's time for a lot of these brands to just kind of, you know, look back and laugh on, like, oh yeah, we use the Elijah Craig legend kind of tongue in cheek.
Uh-huh.
You know, but our whiskey's really good. I mean, I think that's kind of where things are going, is that the history and the marketing and all that stuff, you know, it's led to lawsuits. I mean, it's led to a lot of stuff. But at the end of the day, you like the whiskey. And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of what it all comes down to.
Yeah, when I first came to the United States in 1972, I was trying to figure out what I could buy on the way that I would be able to give to people as like a house present if they did something special for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this green box of Jack Daniels in the duty free shop somewhere along the way. I can't remember where it was. And I had just finished reading a book. It was an American PI, Private Eye novel. And there was a character in it called the man who bought Jack Daniels, the man who liked Jack Daniels. That was the only way he was ever identified in the book. So I bought this bottle of Jack Daniels. I dutifully gave it to somebody along the way. I can't remember who it was now. But I didn't notice what most people don't notice. The man's name was Jack Daniel.
Yeah, that's right.
It wasn't Jack Daniels. It was Jack Daniel, yeah. Apostrophe S. And that was the name of his whiskey. And 98% probably of American Tennessee whiskey drinkers think his name was really Daniels. So we're gonna fix that.
That's actually widespread everywhere, and it's with all the brands, like Maker's Mark. You know, there's an apostrophe in that.
Uh-huh.
There's an apostrophe in Seagram's, but if you just do the Seagram company, you know, there's not an apostrophe.
Uh-huh.
But so that's kind of what's funny about that is that little, you know, grammatical error is kind of throughout all of whiskey.
It's funny.
Anyway,
that's because you're all drinking too much of it.
Yeah, I mean, the label makers have had a little too much product, right?
Exactly.
All you have to do is say the bottle shape is rectangular. It has a black plastic screw cap.
Yeah.
And when you're in need of inspiration, you screw that off and pour some in a glass, and wonderful things happen.
That's it.
And I'm glad our paths crossed, Fred Minnick, because Bourbon Curious contained a lot of information I found very, very interesting about the history of this iconic American beverage. So please keep on writing more about it and make sure that your glass is always full.
Cheers.
Cheers to you.
So there you have it. Until next year when we're in Music City again, undoubtedly, we probably will be persuaded to go,
fun,
I think.
Fun, fun, fun.
Because we certainly had a fun time, and you'd have a fun time if you went too. In fact, you could do that in Nashville just about any time.
Yes.
So anyway, whenever you decide to do that, we'll be sure you'll have a good time. And then you'll have a good time if you join us again next week, same time, same place. And until then,
bye-bye.